On June 29, 1978, Bob Crane, known to Hogan's Heroes fans as Colonel Hogan, was discovered brutally murdered in his Scottsdale, Arizona apartment. His eldest son, Robert Crane, was called to the crime scene. In his new memoir, Crane discusses that terrible day and how he has lived with the unsolved murder of his father. But the storyline is just one thread in his tale of growing up in Los Angeles, his struggles to reconcile the good and sordid sides of his celebrity father, as well as his own fascinating life. As a result of a raucous encounter with the cast of Canada's SCTV, he found himself shelving his notepad and tape recorder to enter the employ of John Candy, first as an on-again, off-again publicist, then as a full-time assistant, confidant, screenwriter, and producer, and finally, as one of John Candy's pallbearers. His new book is Crane, Sex, Celebrity, and My Father's Unsolved Murder. And Robert Crane joins us this morning, and we welcome him to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having us.
Very nice to have you. And is Christopher with you as well?
He is not. He and his wife, Desley, are listening to the show right now from Cornwall.
Okay, great. Well, it's very nice to have you with us, and I appreciate having you here. So you have written other books. I believe you've been on the program with other books that you have written. What brought you to say, okay, I obviously have a hell of a story to tell. Maybe it's time to tell it.
Well, Christopher Fryer, the co-author on this book, and I have written three books together. And those subjects included Jack Nicholson and Bruce Dern. I think you've had Bruce on your show.
Yeah.
And then I've co-authored three other books, and those subjects included an SCTV cast kind of oral history and a book with the late writer-director Tom Mankiewicz of the iconic Mankiewicz family. And each book got better. And what I mean by that is that we were mining for information from each person. And, you know, everybody has their walls up, and to break through those walls and to get really nice, candid stuff was our goal. And I go ahead.
No, I didn't say anything. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're right.
And I noticed that each book got better in terms of getting that information out of people. So Chris and I were talking about some other projects 5 years ago, and he knows my story well. And he said, let's go with the unsolved murder, the small-town Connecticut family moving to Los Angeles for fame and fortune, and everything going wrong story, which is my story. And what better person to, you know, mine that information from? Me. So Chris put on his hard hat and jackhammer and started drilling away.
When it comes to the writing of your father's death, how difficult was that, especially considering there are still so many question marks around it?
I followed one of my writing heroes, Joan Didion, and her last two books, writing about the death of her husband and the other book, the death of her daughter.
Yes.
And she did it in such a way, like she was still reporting. She was a reporter with this clear eye and a detachment. And I was just so impressed with those books. I thought, I'm going to try the same thing. I'm going to step back, if I can take myself out of the picture for a second, gather all the information that I've got. I've got police transcripts and interviews with the district attorney's office. This is out in Scottsdale in Phoenix, Arizona, over the course of, 20 years, and report on it, just like another true crime case. So we came up with what I think is a unique blend of autobiography, biography, and true crime reportage.
With that detachment, I mean, it still has to hit you at some point about what's going on, though. I mean, even within the reporting of it, you live through it as well, which had to be difficult because you're finding out about aspects of your father's life that I assume you were not aware of.
Well, in terms of if you're talking about the sex, lies, and videotape portion of it, I was aware of that. What I had never experienced was seeing my father on a slab, dead in a morgue. That was a new experience. And again, I tried to write about it with Chris. Chris pushing me, you know, why, where, when, how. As a reporter, what did I see? This is the first time I ever saw anything like this. The first time I ever saw, one of my parents dead. So I tried to write as clearly as I could about that, and that was a new experience.
You were there at the crime scene, and not only saw the body at the morgue, but were there at the crime scene as well. So, were you able to put it in any sort of narrative right away as to what could have brought your father to that point where he was murdered?
Yeah, he was out on the road doing a play to make money. He was going through a divorce from his second wife. I'm part of the first family. His second wife, major divorce proceeding going on. He had to earn money. Television work was getting less and less for him, so he had to hit the road. So he was in Scottsdale, Arizona for a month doing a play. And he made what I thought was a series of bad decisions, starting with hooking up with my stepmother, and also as his, quote-unquote, best friend, a guy named John Henry Carpenter, who was right. a Sony and Akai video equipment salesperson. And I think just the combination of those two people led him in a downward direction that he was trying to get out of at the time, just shortly before his death. He told my stepdad, in fact, about changes he was trying to make and losing this quote-unquote friend of his and getting divorced and buying a house in L.A. and starting over. And he just didn't get out of the spiral. And I think those two people, the stepmother and Carpenter, played into his death.
You do talk about and mentioned it a moment ago. So you were aware of your father's fascination with pornography, and as you write in the book, that this is a fascination that had an impact on almost every facet of his life.
Yes. It got him into trouble. My father was like a big kid, and his new toy was home video equipment. Now, you have to remember, back in the 60s and 70s, you know, before cell phones and selfies and all this stuff, home video was the rage, and he was one of the first people in Los Angeles to get it through this guy Carpenter. And these are reel-to-reel videotape decks, you know, with huge cameras looking like they come from Kyrgyzstan, you know, in 1950. And that was the equipment. But he loved photography, he loved editing, and he took this equipment on the road with him, shared it with, you know, castmates and women that he met on the road, everybody a willing participant, and recorded all this stuff. But he behaved like he should just share this toy with everybody, and I think that also got him into trouble.
When you say trouble, that also made getting work difficult, because it started to become a reputation, right?
Yes. For instance, I'll give you one example. After Hogan's Heroes went off, he went to Disney, and he starred in a film that didn't turn out to be very good.
No.
Called Super Dad.
Right.
But they were looking for another Dean Jones. You know, Dean Jones was their kind of milquetoast leading man at the time. And they were looking for another person. My dad possibly could have gotten that position to, you know, be in those kind of Disney films. But the executives up in the front office heard about his hobby going on, you know, and he's sharing it with everybody down the dressing room, and forget it, you know, Disney walked away.
So then you also talk in the book much about your life and going on, and for you, it was originally radio interviewing, and then print as well, right?
Yes, one of our first jobs, in fact, Chris and I, got a big assignment with We Magazine, OUI, when it was owned by Playboy. This was kind of like their, the wicked stepsister magazine for them.
Yeah.
And we got a big assignment with Bruce Dern to interview Bruce Dern, who had just, you know, killed John Wayne and the Cowboys. And we were thrilled, and we thought we made a ton of money at the time, $750. And it was plastered right there in the middle of Wee Magazine for the world to see. And that really started our freelance writing. And I went on to write for Playboy for about 20 years.
And then talk a little bit about the friendship with John Candy, because your career did take a detour at that point upon meeting him out of an interview situation.
Yes, in 1981, I got an assignment from Playboy to cover SCTV, which was my favorite television show at the time. It was a late-night show on NBC. It came on after Johnny Carson Tonight Show. It was like 12:30 in the morning, you know, on Friday nights. But it was the rage at the time. It was the best writing. It was so much better than Saturday Night Live at that time. And a great cast, John Candy and Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hara, and a lot of great people, Martin Short. So I spent a week in Edmonton, Alberta, of all places. That's where they were shooting. And somehow they knew that my dad was Bob Crane before I got there. I don't know how. I never announced it to anybody. This was counter my whole procedure. And what that created, though, was a shorthand with them, and it allowed me into their club for a week because they figured, oh, well, this guy's been around us already. I mean, his dad was on Hogan's, and, you know, he's seen this whole thing already. So I was allowed in, and again, back to talking about mining information, that relaxed everybody, and I was able to get some great information from each cast member, including John Candy, who happened to be a Hogan's Heroes fan. So that was a shortcut for me. I kept interviewing John over the years, and then finally he had an opening at his production company. He wanted an in-house publicist, and he hired me because I had been on the other side as a reporter. So it was a nice route.
What was that friendship like? Because you then get to the point where you're hanging around the guy a lot.
Yes. Oh yeah. Many late nights, Joe. Many late nights. John was a sweetheart. He was one of the kindest people I've ever known. He used his celebrity-dom to its great advantage to help people and help causes. And but, you know, there was a downside, too. He loved his rum and cokes. And he had more energy than everyone at that office put together. So he was a locomotive train that could have kept going all night. And the rest of us are falling by the wayside, you know, taking shifts. And that was the downside of it. And I must note, too, he may go all night, but he would be in makeup at, you know, 6 in the morning and on the set at 7 and know all his lines for the whatever he was shooting at the time. He never missed a beat. And the rest of us are taking naps, you know, in the corner somewhere.
And a good guy and very professional.
Yes.
And somebody that you could work with. I do want to mention that you are going to be at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck with Chris
yes.
Fryer, your co-author, on Friday night at 7 o'clock, and you'll be talking about the book. And it'll be a great event. So again, Rhinebeck, Oblong Books, and you can go to oblongbooks.com for more information on the event. So ultimately, what do you hope people get out of the book and out of the story that you tell about yourself and about your dad and dealing with that, obviously, you know, still dealing with the unsolved murder?
Well, it's really a 50-year journey. For me, it's from about the age of 5 up until about 5 years ago. And it's about a small-town family. We're from Stamford and Bridgeport and Darien, Connecticut. And my dad got an opportunity to be on radio in Los Angeles, and we were the pioneers of that family and headed west. And, you know, all was going well for a while, it seemed like, the little family unit. And then, you know, my dad fell to temptations out in Los Angeles and Hollywood, and it's a downward spiral for family over 20 years. My mom was the rock. She was trying to hold, you know, my sisters and me, and her mother was living with us too, my grandmother, together. And meanwhile, my dad was this meteor, you know, going off on his own. He probably never should have been married, but that's another story. And we go through 50 years. We, you know, life as a kid with my dad, who's now becoming famous and visibly famous, and then Hogan's Heroes, which was a phenomenon for a few years, and then his death, and then my life goes on, as does the rest of the family, and then we go through a terrible police investigation in Scottsdale, and over a decade, going through three district attorneys, and they finally bring Carpenter in for trial. He's acquitted, and we're all dealing with this, and this is over 50 years of life. And of course, I get married, I lose my first wife to cancer, I get remarried to a wonderful woman, Leslie, and it's life and death and crime and trying to stay out of Vietnam and going to college, and it's a little mini American story.
A very full life and a very full book. It is Crane, Sex, Celebrity, and My Father's Unsolved Murder. Robert Crane and his co-author Chris Fryer will be at Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck, New York, Friday night at 7 o'clock for a reading and signing. You can find out more by going to oblongbooks.com. Robert Crane, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. Again, the name of the book, Crane. It's published by Kentucky University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.